Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's talk is given by meditation instructor Marcus Casey. What is the purpose of life? Is the meaning of life only the meaning we give it? We explore these big questions from a Buddhist perspective as we continue our study of Chapter 1 of His Eminence Taisi Tu Rinpoche's book, Ultimately Perfect. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
My name is Marcus Casey, and I'm one of our volunteer meditation instructors at Columbus KTC. We're fortunate to have a couple of lamas that give our teachings on a regular basis, but when they're not around, they've asked a few of us to fill in for them. And this is one of those Sundays. And usually when we do teach, when the meditation instructors teach, we go through a book and do a book study. And right now we're kind of trying something a little different. We've got two books going on. So we've got History of the Karmapas on some weeks, and we're starting a new one today called Ultimately Perfect by Taisi Tu Rinpoche. And so this is the one we'll be using today. And we're doing that. We're mixing it up a little bit just because this is a lot of spiritual biographies, and they're extremely interesting, very fascinating, but some people might not want to do all history all the time kind of thing. So we're gonna intersperse it with other books. So this book is by Taisi Tu Rinpoche. Now, Taisi Tu Rinpoche is the 12th Taisi Tu Rinpoche. He's the 12th in that lineage. It is one of the oldest lineages dating back to the 14th century. And the first Taisi Tu Rinpoche was at the time of the fifth Karmapa. And since that time, he has always been a very close disciple of the Karmapa and one of the heart sons of the Karmapa. So if you ever have an opportunity to hear Taisi Tu Rinpoche speak, please take it, or even look him up on YouTube. He's extremely interesting to listen to, very funny, meanders around when he talks into some really hilarious areas, and is also extremely interesting to listen to. So I probably couldn't do any better than just reading this chapter to you, because then you could catch the humor and things like that he brings to it. But I know that not everyone wants to be read to for a talk, so I know that's not everyone's cup of tea. When we begin, we traditionally say together the four-line refuge prayer at the beginning of our talks. The prayer's in Tibetan. If you know it, sing along with us. If you don't, just follow along and make the aspiration that you will awaken and help others to awaken. When we're chanting this, we're repeating our commitment to take refuge in the three jewels, the Buddha, or the goal, what we aspire to, the Dharma, or the path, and the Sangha, or the guides and companions on the path. We'll chant the prayer three times. Sangje chidang tsogi cho nam la chang chu bar du da ni kap su chi da gi jin so ki pe su nam gi Jola Penchir Sangje Tu Parsho Sangje Chidang Soki Cho Nam La Jang Chu Bardu Dai Ni Kyap Su Chi Dagi Jin Soki Pe Su Nam Gi Drola Penchir Sangje Tu Parsho Sangje Chidang Soki Cho Nam La Jang Chu Bardu Dagni Kyab Su Chi Dagi Jin So Ki Pe Su Nam Gi Dro La Pen Chir Sang Je Du Par Sho. Okay, so we're going to start out today in a little different way, a little differently than at least I've been doing in the talks I've given, and that is we want to start out hearing from you. I want to pose the question to you all that Taisichu Rinpoche was asked, and the reason he gave this talk. So he was asked to talk about the purpose of life. So I want to start out with some answers from you. Don't be shy. No wrong answers. And I know everyone in here is coming at this cold, has not been contemplating this week probably. Although you may, you know, it's one of the big questions, right? So it may be something you've given some thought to in the past. But what do you think? You can just answer from where you are, and I'll repeat it for the recording. But what is the purpose of life? What is the meaning of life? Big question. Anyone have some thoughts? Jim? Great. To be good and take care of myself so that I might be of better service to others. Excellent. Thank you. Yes?
The quest for love and meaning.
Love and meaning. So life is the quest for that. Got it.
It's more than that.
Good. Yes? Overcoming entropy. Oh, okay. Okay. Excellent. We're actually going to talk about a little bit of that too. Yes?
I don't think there is a purpose to life. We just find ourselves evolved and living, but then we're beginning to realize that there's something more than just living.
Okay. So, to repeat for the recording, she said she doesn't think there is a meaning of to life. We've evolved. We find ourselves here, and then it's the meaning we bring to it through our activities. Excellent. Okay. Yes.
Yeah, I pretty much agree with that. I guess I'm adding on that it's whatever purpose you want it to be.
Okay. So you're creating your reality with
but
the...
It's a thing where it all combines to create
okay.
a whole. So, yeah.
Excellent. Thank you. Anyone else? Yes, John.
I think we're all missing the point. It's really about how many likes you get.
About how many likes you get. Yeah,
yeah.
Nice.
I don't know if you guys read it. Four.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to be. After a while, I would probably break the code that the people I knew and hung out with died. And then I would probably make the connection that, wow, everybody's going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And if everybody is going to die, that means probably me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm left with, we're all going towards this end, and so am I. So then, what do I do? I could hang out and do nothing, like I was told, or perhaps help others along the way.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's why I'm here.
Excellent. So, I can't repeat all of that, but...
Again, it's a question like a big
The likes on Facebook, right? So, right. So he said that finding ourselves here, understanding that everyone is going to die. It's all about how you help others along the way. Excellent. Okay. Well, let's dig in and see what Taisichu Rinpoche said, because I think a lot of you have different pieces and parts of a lot of what he said. So let's look at it. Thanks for your responses. And thanks for being brave enough to answer. I know sometimes we have a lot of ego attachment to what people think of us, and are afraid that we won't get enough likes to what we say. So I know how that is. I've been plagued with an outsized concern for what people think of me, and so it's not always easy to step out on a limb like that. So thank you for speaking up, everyone. So the first thing Taisichu Rinpoche says is that in order to talk about the purpose of life, we first have to have a definition of life and a definition of purpose. You can really tell he was given a classical Buddhist education in a monastery in philosophy, right? So he's going right to the definitions. But as you see, he's absolutely correct that we need to unpack some of the definitions in order to answer this well, because we can get kind of stuck if we define some of this wrong. So he says, what is life? Are we talking about breathing and eating and talking? And, is that life? And if so, what about when we're not sleeping and eating and talking? And what about those moments between? Are we alive or not? And then he says, when we talk about purpose, there can be two aspects. Why are we here? And that's, why are we here and what are we here for? And he says, why are we here is looking back. And what are we here for is looking forward. And I think some of you touched on that too, that we may just find ourselves here. So what is the, what's the looking forward aspect of it? And others of you were talking about the other one about, why are we here? So there's two aspects to that. And he says, or are we just asking, what is this? Why do I look like me and why do you look like you? Is that what we're asking here? So he starts out by giving his short answer and then he'll elaborate and that'll be the rest of the talk. But he gives the spoiler right at the beginning. He says, we have to make this life meaningful and we have to make this life purposeful. We're already here regardless of the whys. And if we want it to be purposeful and meaningful, we have to make it so. It is in our hands. It is in our hands to do that, and it is in our hands to live a meaningless and purposeless life as well. And that's not hard to do. And but if we make this life meaningful and purposeful, it is good for us and for everyone else. So many of us, I think, when we think about the question of the purpose of life, we tend to automatically jump to the meaning of this life, this particular life. And Rinpoche understands that's probably where some of us are coming from, so he addresses that right away. He says, one thing we have no control over, regardless of whether we make it purposeful or not, is that our life will go on and we can't do anything about it. No one can even end their life. We talk like we can, like it's possible. But what we're actually talking about when we talk about that is someone ending their body. He says they actually haven't ended their mind. What makes their body a live body is the mind living in it. He says it's like an occupied house. When the house becomes unlivable, our bodies become an unoccupied house, and the person who was living in the house has checked out. Our body is like a cage, and our mind is like a bird. Some people like their cage very much, and some people don't like their cage. So for the definition of life, we really have to look further than just our mind in this body at this time. We have to remember that our mind goes on beyond this. It is not obstructed by walls or a speed limit. Rinpoche says, it is slower than a mountain and faster than the speed of light, all at the same time, here and there at the same time. So after we die, are we alive at that time? And Rinpoche says, yes, of course we're alive all the time. We are primordial. Our body can be dead, but our mind is alive. So if we think about the purpose of life in a very casual way and don't think really deeply, he says we're talking about the purpose of functioning in this body and living through this childhood, being a teenager and an adult, getting old, all of this life. And what is the purpose of this life? And Rinpoche says just answering that question is actually kind of a simple, superficial, casual perception of life. Why am I born here? What am I supposed to do? Why do I have two hands and legs? Why am I able to talk and listen? Why do I have to eat three meals a day? If we talk about it that way, if we talk about it from looking back, then he says the purpose of life is to work out the causes and conditions of the past because we are a product of the past. We're not an accident. We're not somebody's experiment. Each one of us is a unique masterpiece of all of our actions and intentions of countless lifetimes in the past. And we can ask ourselves, what did I do to become like this? What did I do in the past that has made me who I am? And if we look at it that way, then the purpose of life is to undo all the bad things that we've done in countless previous lifetimes and to enhance all the good things that we have done. That's the purpose of life in that context. Otherwise, what's going to happen is exactly the same things that have happened and are happening to us. We'll just go on. The entropy comment. If we don't make an intention to change our patterns and our habits, then we're just going to continue on. Exactly the patterns that brought us into this life are just going to continue on to take us into the next. And the chaos and the lack of control that we experience over what we've brought in from the past. The idea then is to realize that the only way to change that and to have some control over what we do in the future and what our circumstances are in the future is with our behavior right now. So he compares our lives and our mind and the continuation to the river Ganges. He lives in India these days. So he says, in some places it's very loud and ferocious. In other places it's very calm and peaceful. In some places it's moving very fast, and in other places it's hardly moving at all. Some places it's very, very dirty, and in some places it's very, very clean. But it's the same river Ganges from the beginning to the end. Similarly, you may be called by different names and have different characteristics, sometimes human, sometimes an animal, and if we don't do anything about it, we'll just continue in that cycle. But if we use this life to do our best to undo all the negative aspects of it, to purify the negative aspects by using all of the positive aspects to improve all the positive aspects, so we use the positivity we have to increase our positivity, then we'll improve from one life to another. To the extent that we do that, we can call this a meaningful life. Otherwise, we can call it a meaningless life. We lived and died, and that's it. There's no such thing as a purpose of life that is something solid. We have to make this life purposeful and meaningful. Now, Taisitu Rinpoche gives the example of Buddha Shakyamuni. And that's the historical Buddha that lived 2,500 years ago. So the Buddha Shakyamuni, it's said, had countless past lives. trillions of eons of past lives of good karma. He had taken a vow to be a benefit to others many, many lifetimes ago. And because of all that good karma, he was born a prince. He was born as Prince Siddhartha. He was not born as Buddha Shakyamuni. He was born as Prince Siddhartha, and the problem with that was that his father, the king, wanted him to become the most powerful king. And he meant well. No one loves their children more than no one loves any of us more than our parents, right? So it was a good thing, and that's generally speaking, but it was a good thing for his father to want him to be a king. Because he was already a prince and he wanted him to be a very big king. But there's a flaw there. To go from being a regular king to being a very big king, Rinpoche says, you have to do things to make your kingdom bigger. And there aren't a lot of new ways to make your kingdom bigger than, you know, the ways to make a kingdom bigger now are the same as they were then. So that really was the negative aspect of Prince Siddhartha's life. He had a lot of expectations on him, really, to do some very negative things. And everything was provided for him, so he didn't really have to do anything to get anything. He was born to a very, very important royal family, and everything was provided for him. When he was born, special priests were invited to read his life. The priest told his father that if Prince Siddhartha remained and became a king, he would be very good, a very big and powerful king. But if he renounced the kingdom, he would become highly enlightened. And his father was devastated by the thought that he might renounce his kingdom. And he was a little bit greedy, so it was kind of good news, bad news. So the kingdom could expand, but only if he could keep his son from renouncing his kingdom. If he could, he might become the biggest king in the world. So what his father chose to do was, in Taisichu's words, very neurotic. He tried to hide everything from Prince Siddhartha that was negative or unpleasant. Wherever the prince went, everything was made perfect in front of him, so he had no idea what was going on. When I think of this, I actually think of the movie The Truman Show. I don't know if any of you have ever seen The Truman Show, right? He basically created a false reality for his son. But despite all these obstacles, Rinpoche says, negative becomes positive if you have good karma, because your good karma becomes more powerful. And that's what happened with Prince Siddhartha. He wanted to see what was out there, and he found a way. And that became a big motivating factor in his life. So even though he had been sheltered from everything, he ended up going out, and he would ask his chariot driver, you know, what's going on here? And the chariot driver would say, that's a sick person. And Prince Siddhartha said, can I be sick? And yes, of course you can be. We all can. And similarly, he saw a funeral procession and asked about dying and discovered that everyone dies. And he saw someone who was old and discovered that that we all grow old. So even though the king had done everything in his power to keep him from experiencing what was negative, he came to see old age, sickness, and death. And it became his primary motivation. So he saw the truth, and as a result, he renounced everything from the palace. He wanted to make his life meaningful. He wanted to find a way to be free from all the suffering so that he could free everyone else from that. Now, Taisichu Rinpoche says, people ask him, and I've heard people ask here too, now, wasn't it selfish to leave his family and go off meditating? And Rinpoche says that when you understand bodhicitta, you understand that the Buddha left them behind not because he didn't care for them, but because he cared for them limitlessly. Because of his care for his family, his kingdom, and all sentient beings, this limitless care, he sacrificed everything for them. How could he free them if he himself was not free? So how, I mean, yes, he could be there and be part of their lives, but he was completely powerless over old age, sickness, and death, and over the things that he realized that were part of everyone's life, unless he could explore that and reach the end of that and then help them to do the same. So he wanted to make the best use of his Prince Siddhartha life, and it took him many years to do that. It took him many years to attain enlightenment, and then he became Buddha Shakyamuni. He made the choice, he made the sacrifice, and he made the effort. Taisichu Rinpoche says he can't say that the purpose of our lives is to become a Buddha, because that's up to each individual person. It's what you choose. You might choose to be a great designer or an architect. Whatever you achieve will be according to whatever you wish to achieve. There is no accidental enlightenment in which you are enlightened by mistake. So everything is intention. Everything is cause and result. But he says the final enlightenment is beyond cause and result. Cause and result applies up to a certain stage. Then you move beyond cause and result, and you become what you eventually are, what you actually are. It's not that you become something else. If you are becoming something else, then it needs a cause and a result. But in becoming what you are, cause and result make no difference. It is non-dual. Enlightenment, he says, is beyond duality. Until a certain stage, it's cause and result, but after that stage, you just evolve and become. Anything that is the result of causes and conditions, he says, is impermanent. Because when those causes and conditions are removed, then the result is removed. If enlightenment were the result of causes and conditions, then it too would be impermanent. You could be a Buddha today and then not a Buddha tomorrow. And if it were impermanent, then you could lose it. But enlightenment is actually beyond impermanence. If you are a very good person, but your level of realization has not exceeded the threshold where it is beyond the result of causes and conditions, he says, then there are certain things that can make that all fall apart. So there is a threshold. And that's as much as he says about that, and that's as much as I can say about that, is to repeat his words. So now he gets into the how. How do we make this life purposeful? He said, we could say the purpose of life is to work out all the karma we've accumulated, but that's not really a purpose. It will happen anyway. So we go to the next stage where the purpose is to make everything meaningful or useful. And he says, so we can talk. So let's make our talking useful. Say prayers. We can see. So let's do it purposefully. Read texts. We can hear. So make that purposeful. Listen to the Dharma. We can do things that are good for ourselves and good for others. We can think, so think positively. Don't waste time by thinking negatively or overcomplicating things. And I'll repeat that last sentence. Don't waste time by thinking negatively or overcomplicating things. So what he's saying here is that negative thoughts are a waste of your life. They waste your chance to bring meaning and purpose to your life. The many, many volumes of the Buddha's teaching, more than 100 volumes, and we had the texts of the full canon in our center before it burned. And I think they were rescued, but they're kind of beyond repair. So we will be getting new ones when we have a new building, and we'll install those. He says that that would be more than 100 volumes if they were translated into English. What they have translated, it really grows. But he says all of that can be summed up with three slogans. And that is, abandon what is harmful or negative or non-virtuous. Practice what is helpful or positive or virtuous. And tame your mind. And of course, that third one, tame your mind, is the way we're able to more skillfully do the first two. Abandon what is harmful and practice what is helpful. So he says we have many, many practices that help us to develop these. We have sadhanas, prayers, rituals, things like that. He also says we have the Mahamudra practice. Another aspect of practice that is not really ritual or visualization, but directly practicing. And he says that's actually harder. He says it's easier to follow the rituals and prayers because you have something to do. You do this first, then this. We use our bodies, our eyes, our ears, our speech, our thoughts. So we're totally engaged in the practice. And he said this is very noble and sacred and necessary. But there is another practice that's also noble and sacred, and it doesn't involve any kind of ritual. And he said if we can do it, it is just simply allowing our ultimate potential to develop and mature by itself. It sounds wonderful, but it's difficult to do because we have to do nothing. We have to do nothing and let the naturalness manifest by itself. He says, we do nothing and the sun comes up and goes across the sky and sets, and we have a very peaceful night. And then the sun comes up, a very bright day, and then another peaceful night. It all happens without doing anything. We don't have to do anything. So if we are not able to not do anything, just rest in our nature, just rest in our primordial essence, that is the best meditation. But it's very hard to do. And that's why the rituals and the sadhanas are the most helpful practices for us right now. He said people come to him and say that they're very bad meditators and that they have a hard time meditating. And he asks them why, and they say, I always have thoughts coming into my mind, and my feet hurt and my back hurts and it's boring. And he says to them, okay, I have something for you. Do this practice 200,000 times and this other practice 10,000 times, and then there will be no time to get bored. If you get pins and needles by sitting, just stand up and do prostrations. You never get pins and needles and you'll never fall asleep. So he goes on to say there are so many methods. The traditional saying is that the Buddha taught 84,000 methods for waking up. And that's a really high number. But he says actually the number is much, much higher because everyone approaches practices in their own way. So he said you take the 7 billion people on the planet and multiply that by the 84,000 methods, and that's your actual number. So there are lots of methods to use to wake up. And he says that we should be careful not to get ahead of ourselves. Right now, our job is to bring meaning and purpose to this life. Right now, our job is to take our activities and start to bring purpose to them and start to recognize where we are not bringing purpose to them. And let the results take care of themselves. We're basically changing to a different kind of inertia and building that up. So getting back to the original question, what is the purpose of life? There is no purpose. We have to make it purposeful because of all the karma that we've created. We've done that all by mistake. And the next section I'm just going to read. I think it's beautiful. He says, we are limitless in potential, but we have mistaken that as I. You cannot find anything in the whole universe more limited than I. But you also cannot find a bigger problem in the universe than I. I may have said that wrong. You cannot find anything in the whole universe more limited than I. You cannot find a bigger problem in the universe than I. If there is no I, then there is no problem. Because all problems come from I, and all the karma that is created is based on I. I is ignorance, because we don't understand that we are limitless, and therefore we are limited. And I want to be me, I, and you are not me. I like to hear these things. I don't like to hear those things. I want to see these things. I don't want to see those things. All this comes because there is I, and I is a mistake, a very big mistake. But what can we do? From our hair to our bone marrow, everything is soaked in I. As long as we have a single drop of blood running in our veins, we will call ourselves I. As long as there is a single breath left in our body, we will call ourselves I. So what do we do now? Just avoid the word I? He says that gets more complicated and causes all kinds of problems. But he said, when you look at it this way, you start to realize that it's all an illusion. And you start to realize that if you're narrowing this down to what is the purpose of my life, you can let that illusion creep into the question. And what we have to do then is we have to bring meaning to everything that we do so that we can start to move beyond that attachment to I and start to move toward awakening. And we do that by practicing the three slogans, by taming our minds so that we can abandon what is harmful and practice what is helpful. And in doing that, we will work out our karma. In doing that, it will become possible for us to engage more and more with the practices, and possible for us to ultimately rest in our own primordial nature, in actually who we are, and wake up in that realization. So I hope this has been helpful. We have some time for questions, and we have a question mic open over here. So love to hear some questions or thoughts, feedback, things you want to elaborate on based on what you've heard, any of that. Feel free to come up to the microphone and let's just keep the conversation going.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
My question is suggestions on easy steps to tame the mind, or mm-hmm. beginning steps to mm-hmm. tame the mind.
Mm-hmm. And that's why we're here. I mean, quite literally, that's why we exist as a center, is to help guide people through that very thing. And so we teach intro to meditation on a weekly basis, every week upstairs, intro to meditation. And we do that because that's our starting point. Our starting point is to help settle our mind some, help get a little bit of clarity, help get a little bit of calm in all the noise so that we can start to deal skillfully with our minds. So we teach that through shine or shamatha meditation, quiet sitting meditation. And in quiet sitting meditation, we sit in our posture and we start to breathe and we place our minds on an object, usually the breath, and we notice every time our attention wanders from the breath. And we let that go. We say, oh, I'm thinking. Oh, my mind wandered. We let that go. We rest our attention again on the breath until it wanders again, and we catch it, and we let that go, and we return. And the point of that whole exercise, and we continue to do that over and over a little bit on a regular basis, and what we're doing is we're building a muscle. We're building new patterns in our minds. And what we're doing is every time we notice and return, we are developing for ourselves a pattern where we have a little bit of separation from the content of our thoughts. So that then off the cushion, when we find ourselves just with a barrage of negativity and negative thoughts and thoughts that are just going around and round telling us that this is negative and maybe it's depression, maybe it's outrage, whatever it is, all those things that get to us and cause us anxiety and worry and on and on. We come to learn in meditation how to notice that and settle it. Even with little micro meditations throughout the day, we learn to do a little body scan and settle that down. So that's the first step in taming our minds. Now, once we've done that for a little while, we start in our tradition to then take on some more practices that involve some visualizations and things where we work with the mind. And we might move on to a practice in which we learn to develop our compassion by taking on the suffering of others and breathing out our happiness to them. And with a mind that's practiced in meditation, that's a lot easier to do. And we do that because at that point we're starting to address that problem of attachment to our own ego, to our I. And in developing that love and compassion for others, then we're breaking those habits of attachment that cause us so much suffering. And then we move on, and we have many, many other practices beyond that to address a lot of our negative aspects. But I love your question, and that's why I've answered it in such a long way, because that really is why we exist as a center. And I'll say, in addition to our intro classes, we encourage everyone to attend those intro classes when they first start coming. But then we have a mentorship program. If you want to then move beyond and start working with someone, one of our meditation instructors, on setting up a daily practice and maybe setting up a shrine and different practices you can move on to and more in-depth one-on-one instruction on Shine and Shamatha, then we have a mentorship program. And then we also have our lamas are available for interviews, and you can schedule time with them to discuss your own personal practice. And at that point, you're starting with the basics, but you're really moving into working with someone who can skillfully work with your own mind and the way you work, so that we can skillfully learn to tame our minds. And the benefit of that is we're more mindful in our interactions with others, so that we can practice what is helpful without the burden of being out of control with our attachment to ego. And we can do a better job then of being helpful to others. So, excellent question. Thank you.
That was very helpful. Thank you, Marcus.
Anyone else?
Yeah, thanks for your lecture, and I got a lot out of it. You're talking about being, being absorbed with overcomplication and negativity. Meditation, I think a lot of the norm in society is to try to look for distractions all the time. You know, mm-hmm. I want to be entertained. You know, and mm-hmm. just in some kind of self-image, mm-hmm. egotistical self-image fulfillment mm-hmm. things. Meditation. What I find is, I'm confronted with this absurd self that I create, and I simplify. But there's a lot of negativity that I feel that normally I don't confront mm-hmm. in a normal time because I distract myself all the time. Mm-hmm. When I meditate, I find a lot of times I feel mm-hmm. certain depression. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's normal. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming. So.
Yeah. So, Lama Kathy has talked about getting this all the time. People come to her and say, I'm a terrible meditator because every time I sit down to meditate, you know, all this stuff comes up and my mind just races. And the truth is, that's what your mind was doing under the surface all along.
Yeah.
In meditation, you're stopping and you're noticing that. But in meditation, we take a very gentle approach with our minds. We don't want to judge all the things that are coming up. So we don't want to say, oh, that's negativity. That's not what I'm supposed to do, you know, and try to just through force of effort, try to change that. When you're meditating, what you want to do is you notice the arise of it and you just don't grasp onto it. You just return to the breath and you let it go back down naturally. Our teachers tell us that thoughts are of the same substance of the mind. Negative thoughts or positive thoughts. Thoughts are of the same substance of the mind, just as waves are of the same substance as the ocean. And to ask our minds not to create thoughts is like asking the ocean not to create waves. But what we don't have to do, so we don't have to get in meditation and start telling our mind to stop having these thoughts, you know, trying to tell the ocean to stop having the waves. It's going to be pretty fruitless. Similarly, but at the same time, we don't have to follow every wave, every thought that comes through and follow it to its conclusion. We can sit on the beach and watch the rising and fall in a very peaceful way. So what you're doing is you're developing that separation. Those negative thoughts will come up. And negative thoughts and emotions may cause a physical reaction in you. It's a mental disturbance. It will be there. But honestly, we fall into a pitfall if we try to if we think that the purpose of our meditation is to make sure those don't come up, because that's not actually what we're sitting on the cushion trying to do. We're sitting on the cushion training our minds to let them come and go without attachment. So it's the attachment to that negativity that we're letting go of. I kind of think of it in terms of, exercising or working out, right? You go to the gym. If you sit down and meditate on a day when you're just totally in the zone and you sit down and very few thoughts are coming up and it's easy and, you know, that's great. That's telling you maybe that your meditation's paying off, and sometimes we have those days. But in some ways, that's like going to the gym and, you know, picking up 5 pounds and doing it and say, oh, I feel great, you know, because you there was very little resistance. But when you actually encounter all that resistance and you sit there, and you touch it, and you let it go, and you return to your breath, even if it's just for 2 or 3 seconds, even if your mind takes you away again, you're really, you know, you're doing the work at that point. And that is the work. That is why you're sitting down and that is you working on taming your mind. It's not a fast process. You should never expect anything from any individual meditation session. It's a long-term deal. And what's going to actually help you make the progress is all those times you're able to touch and return. So does that answer?
What I find is it's helpful. A lot of times what I find, I have to work for silence. Because I could stop a stupid story from going on. You know, I'll be sitting there and have some dumb story going, okay, well, that's enough of that. But, you know, a lot of times it's just underlying emotions. And then what I find is, you know, sometimes I feel like I need want to scream. And not so much now as it used to be. And so I have to work on silence.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of the curse of the meditator that once you've seen what's going on under there, you kind of can't unsee it, right?
Yeah.
So it's going to be going on under there, whether or not you're working with it or not. I would encourage you, if there are very specific emotions that continue to come up and continue to come up, that you might bring those up to Lama Kathy or Lama Tom and ask them for a skillful way to work with those. Because we have specific practices that are designed for developing our minds in certain ways and for dealing with certain things. So that might be something you want to address. But yeah, just know that you peeked under the covers, and you know that's there. And we don't want to judge our minds. We want to be gentle, but you can't unsee it. That's it's there for you to deal with. But now you know. Now there's an awareness, and so now you just have to develop the skills to work with that.
Thanks.
Excellent. All right. Anyone else?
I always enjoy when you do your presentations. I'm not even sure how or if this fits under the category along with meditation. And I practice meditation on a fairly regular basis and all that, and feel real comfortable with it. I realize now after so long that when I have the days when it is a lot of mind chatter or whatever, I'm pretty good at just try to let it go, not be judgmental, and then really enjoy the days when it's like I'm not too far and in between. But I wondered, one of the things I continually, and it seems to become more so over time, I love the readings. I love getting literature and books and history and more insights from different lamas and people on their take on all the different aspects of Buddhism. And while I'm reading, for me, it almost takes on a form. I almost feel as comfortable and relaxed and everything as meditating. So far, I kind of keep them as in two different boxes. I mean, I know what I'm reading eventually has an effect on my mind and my thinking and all this sort of thing. And it works together. Like, that's why we come for a class on meditation. I need to hear that or read about it before I could really go deeper in the practice of it. But is there any sort of connection or way of viewing the two, or do we just really keep them separate of meditation and all the different books that we offer that are available? Because I find great value and I really like the time reading.
So I would answer it by saying it depends. So number one, I would say this is something you should probably work with Lama Kathy on, for example. I kind of have two thoughts, and one of them is from my own experience. I like to read, and in the past, when I've had a lot of time for reading, I really would do that a lot of that reading. And in the same way, I very much responded to that reading and really felt like it was changing my mind. Listening to the Dharma, and this is our modern form of listening to the Dharma, is a lot of times is reading the books, is absolutely a virtuous activity and part of the path. But the reason I say I would talk to Lama Kathy about it is I don't think you want to replace your meditation with that. I do think there's a place for the meditation, and there's a place for the Dharma study. Now that said, there our teachers teach us ways to study the Dharma in which we read or listen and then contemplate and then rest our minds in meditation. So kind of a three-part process where we do work them together in that way, where we read, we contemplate what we've read, and then at the end we settle our minds and rest naturally in meditation. So I would say that might be something you want to do, with the caveat that I would never advise you to give up your formal practice that you do in favor of that. But yes, I think that's definitely a great way to spend your time and a way to bring purpose and meaning to your life. So, yes.
Thank you.
All right. Well, let's dedicate the merit of being here today and of listening to the words of Thaisi Chu Rinpoche as he discussed the purpose of life. May we bring meaning and purpose to all of our activities and bring to them the motivation of perfect bodhicitta. By practicing bodhicitta, may we awaken and guide all beings to awaken. By the merit of being here and listening today, may all beings wake up. Thank you all.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.